welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, I'll be talking to legal expert Jody Raphael about rape culture and why it's so hard to prosecute rapes. A high school senior stands up to an abstinence-only liar, and Kansas encourages its violent militants in their quest to end legal abortion. Sex educator Julie Sunday posted a lecture she gave for Nerd Night in Austin, Texas, about the state's long-standing war on legal sex toys.
It's also illegal to have six or more, and as I said before, I have a small arsenal. And I think that maybe the legislator thought they were, like, giving people a pass. You know, like, oh, you've been a normal citizen, they will have five or fewer. That's reasonable. And you go to Vegas for the weekend, you buy a bunch of sex toys, and you bring them back into the state, and that is legal. It's legal to have five or fewer and then bring them back into the state. But that's a really sort of narrow perspective, I think, on what is possible.
The law was overturned by the court, who found it was a violation of the decision Lawrence versus Texas that found that the state cannot monitor safe, consensual sexual activity that adults have in private. Abstinence-only programs have faded somewhat from public consciousness as federal support has dwindled and public opinion has turned against them. Still, that shouldn't let any of us be fooled into thinking they've disappeared. As long as there are Christian right-wing fanatics getting jobs in education and thinking it's appropriate to use school resources to shove their religious beliefs on the students, abstinence only is going to crop up. Now there's a conflict in West Virginia because high school student Caitlin Camblin filed an injunction against her principal to prevent him from retaliating against her for telling the press about the terrible abstinence-only speaker Pam Stenzel being hired to shove Christian propaganda at the students. Caitlin went on HuffPost Live to talk about her struggles.
So basically, I found out about Pam Stenzel the night before the assembly from one of my teachers who called me. And I guess if you guys want to look at my Facebook page, teachers received a flyer from Mr. Allenbach, our principal, the night before the assembly. And it cited that Pam would be testifying as to God's plan for sexual purity. And that's what tipped me off. So immediately, I'm 17, I Googled her. That's my immediate response. So I, after reading a couple reviews of Stenzel, I knew that I wasn't going to agree with her message. So I decided at that point that I wasn't going to go to the assembly. I started to advertise via social media what the assembly was about, so other people had the option not to go if they didn't want to.
The reason she got the injunction is she claims he threatened to call Wellesley College, where Caitlin has a scholarship, and try to get them to revoke her admittance. The university responded to the charges on Twitter by saying they think Caitlin is great and they can't wait to have her as a student. The school is a famous women's university that promotes feminist values, making it laughable in the extreme that anyone would think they'd be opposed to a student speaking up for comprehensive sex education. It's shameful that any school anywhere would hire Pam Stenzel, even for free, to do her shtick of yelling at students and shaming them for being sexual human beings. In a recording one of the students of the high school took, you get to hear Stenzel say terrible, terrible, false things. I listened to the recording, which is nearly an hour long, to hear these terrible things. Believe me, it wasn't easy. It's basically being yelled at for an hour by someone who clearly just hates everyone because she thinks they're a bunch of filthy lust monsters. For instance, she threatens the girls, telling them if they have sex, they'll become infertile.
Girls! Infertility, the inability to have children of your own biologically, has risen over 500% among women in 10 years. The girls who graduated from TW in 2003, many of them are just now today finding out they will never have children because of choices they make sitting where you're sitting. Girls, you find out 5 years from now, 10 years from now, that you can't have children for whatever reason. And all the money you and your husband have spent trying to get pregnant girls doesn't work. Chances you'll be able to adopt an infant in this country aren't good.
CECAS has a report about the lies Pam Stenzel tells, and needless to say, her claim that infertility has skyrocketed is just wrong. They report evidence that shows that infertility rates haven't changed and point out that the increased attention to it is the result of more women having children in their 30s and 40s. But as far as Stenzel is concerned, the entire world is a seething mass of disease and decay, and it's all because they have the icky, gross sex.
Our university campuses are one big, giant disease. 14,000 of them teenagers, high school kids, who got up this morning and said something like, I'm sure somebody in here, well, it's not going to happen to me.
Listening to this talk, you get the impression that the only way that someone can ever catch a disease is to have sex. And of course, that everyone who has sex is crippled with disease. It's extremely silly. For one thing, 95% of Americans have premarital sex. So her insinuation that having sex without a wedding band means being a disease-ridden pariah forever simply doesn't pass the common sense test. Second of all, there are other ways disease is transmitted. You go to college and abstain from sex, okay. But you're still around other people, and so you'll probably catch the flu or a cold plenty enough. If STIs are so bad that one should basically put their entire sexual and romantic life on hold to avoid them, then why don't other diseases require the same level of overreaction? If the only solution to STIs is abstaining from sex by the same logic, the only solution to the flu is abstaining from seeing other people at all. She tries to get around this by claiming that we're all going to die from untreatable diseases if we have premarital sex, or that if you have sex, it will make you unmarriageable because of your supposed status as a leper.
Which is a lovely thing, boys, when you're getting ready to get married. Found this girl you love. I mean, this is it. She's the one you want to marry. All those other girls, that was just messing around. This is the real thing. Pull out that diamond. Look her in the eyes. If you're really cool, boys, you get on your knees. You say, marry me. By the way, I've got genital warts. You'll get it too, and we'll both be treated for the rest of our lives. In fact, you'll probably end up with a radical hysterectomy, cervical cancer, and possibly death. But marry me. Well, I'm excited now. Thanks for sharing.
She seems to be referring to HPV, which is a common STI that does cause genital warts and can lead, in a small number of cases, to cervical cancer. She loves the phrase radical hysterectomy. But for women who are getting regular pap smears, cervical cancer can be easily prevented by a very short procedure that is nothing like a hysterectomy, much less a quote-unquote radical one. She lies, of course, by painting HPV as a lifelong curse, when it causes no problems in most people and goes away on its own most of the time. More to the point, she completely neglects to tell her audience that they can avoid HPV altogether by getting vaccinated. Anyone who actually cares about preventing STIs would tell a room full of kids to get this simple vaccination. I'm getting the feeling that she wants kids to get HPV as punishment for inevitably defying her orders to simply not have sex. If you detected a note of sarcasm in her discussion of the concept of love, you aren't mistaken. Throughout this entire speech, Stenzel talks about love with a tone of contempt and seems to find it implausible that sexually active people can even know what love is.
Love would never ask you to do something that could damage you for the rest of your life. Girls ask me this every day. Boys never ask this. Girls ask me this daily. Well, how do I know if it's love? How would I know if he loved me? He said it. My heart's pounding. He's cute. Girls, there's only one way you will ever know if that boy loves you. One way, sweetheart, put a boundary down. Say this far and no further, and watch for respect.
Yep, she basically comes right out and says that if a man wants to have sex with you, he doesn't love you. She tries to frame it as a boundaries issue to make it sound better, but if you really think about it, this is about sex and not respect. She seems to think that the only way men respect women is to not want sex, and that women never ever want sex, and only have it to please men. The possibility that men and women choose together to have sex for fun, or God forbid, express their love, isn't even entertained here. Good on Caitlin Campbell for standing up to her school for bringing Pam Stenzel in. No teenager deserves to be treated to such a misanthropic, hateful liar who wants you to believe you're a dirty person for having sex. I'd like to welcome Jody Raphael to the program. Jody is a visiting professor of law and a senior research fellow at the Schiller, Ducanto, and Fleck Family Law Center at DePaul, where she researches and writes in the area of violence against women. She has a new book out titled Rape is Rape, How Denial, Distortion, and Victim Blaming Are Fueling a Hidden Acquaintance Rape Crisis. Welcome to RealityCast, Jody.
Thank you.
So people hear a phrase like rape is rape and often think, no, duh. But in reality, it's not that simple. Why do we need to remind people that rape is rape?
We have seen, and what got me going on this topic is that we have seen a steady decline in rape prosecutions. If you look at the ratio of reports to arrests for forcible rape in the 1970s, they're at the 50% range. But by 2006, that has decreased down to 26.5%. That's the lowest charging rate of any crime in the Uniform Crime Reports. And this pattern was not seen for other forms of violent crime during the time. And in my own state of Illinois, the rate is down to 17%, which is well below the national average. So this means that the bulk of rapes are committed by people that one knows, and the huge number of rapes are not taken seriously by law enforcement and prosecutors. And basically, I think because it is acquaintance rape, it's not rape anymore. It's bad sex.
Is the declining arrest rate because more women are reporting acquaintance rape, or is it because of other things?
Actually, there has been an increase in rape reporting since 1974, but we have had no significant increases in rape reporting since the mid-1990s. So we have really been static. So you can't say that this represents more reports being made. Unfortunately, the large majority of people who are subject to rape are not reporting it to law enforcement.
And so basically your book points to a culture where rape denial is widespread to explain why this is happening. Can you talk a little bit about what rape denial is?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about the rape culture and, in the Steubenville case and other cases involving high school athletes, communities are, coming to support the football players and so on. And so this has been considered to be a support of rape and a rape culture. I look at it as basic, a little bit differently. I look at it as a concerted campaign over the last 25 years to deny rape prevalence, and it takes, and in the book I document this campaign, and it really takes two forms. One is to attack rape prevalence statistics, and to manipulate them and fallaciously attack them. And the second is to say, okay, well, the prevalence statistics, they are what they are, but the bulk of women, over 50% of women, lie about rape. And so therefore, this is so damaging to rape victims if what's thought about our culture is that most women are lying about rape. And rape, there are a number people who want to deny rape prevalence are busy with their op-eds and busy influencing people in the media. And they have they're coming at this from a variety of agendas.
So let's talk about their agendas. Obviously, I think most people are most familiar with rape denialists kind of coming from like a secular, just sort of gross, sexist, chauvinist culture. But there's more going on than that. Can you talk about the sort of different agendas that are going on when it comes to people trying to minimize the realities of rape?
Yes, I think what you're referring to is, this idea that it's very threatening to think of being accused of rape. So there's a real male fear and a female fear that men are going to be accused of rape. The majority of men are not rapists. I want to make that clear. But we have groups of women and organized groups that use this issue as an argument against feminism. And so they're arguing about women's liberation now, and they're using the rape issue. They are anti-promiscuity advocates. They believe that rape we're seeing more rape because women are not at home. They're out in the bars and they're drinking and they're putting themselves at risk, and that basically it's all their fault. if they just stayed home. It makes it difficult if a person is sexually active. They can't really be a rape victim for these people. Then we have feminists who are basically responding to this purity movement. And for them, rape as an issue interferes with the promotion of sexual liberation. I mean, if it's so dangerous out there for sex, then they're afraid women will be afraid and will go back, you know, to their homes and not exercise their freedoms. And so basically this group wants to argue and say that rape is really not as prevalent as, you know, as I'm saying it is. And then when I was writing the book, and it was very, really, really frustrating, last summer I had to deliver the manuscript, and then we have another category of rape deniers raise their heads, and that is the anti-abortion advocates. And you remember the man running in Missouri for Senate.
Todd Akin.
Yes, Todd Akin. And he basically said that, again, some of this false science, but basically they want to argue that against exemptions for abortions, that they don't want to see any exemptions whatsoever. So they want to claim that you don't need this exemption because pregnancy is not going to occur during a rape. You know, hidden defenses will kick in to prevent pregnancies in forcible situations. But the result is that those claiming pregnancy in forcible rape situations are going to have to be lying then about the rape. So here's another group out there with a different agenda who is again saying in a drumbeat, women are lying about rape. And we know, of course, that that is the science that he's talking about is totally false. So putting forth all this, these erroneous statistics, really create the reality, this false reality that women who are claiming pregnancy as a result of rape are lying about the rape.
So it's interesting to me. I mean, what do you think about, say, the slut walk protests where women were basically going out and saying, yes, we're sexually active. Yes, we like to drink and party or have sex or do all these things, but the rapes that happen against us are no less rape for it.
Well, I say that what they are, their message and their activism is very, very important. They are taking a much more important stance. I talked about some of the feminists that really don't want to see women, you know, go back and all have to be virgins before they get married and that type of thing. But rather than denying the prevalence of rape, they are dealing with the issue. And basically, they are saying that, do we want a culture in which, let's say, a young woman drinks to excess and passes out? If you have a son, do you want your son at this party then raping, you know, taking advantage of this woman and raping it? And do you want all your other people there taking pictures of this event on their cell phones and calling her slut and whore and this type of thing? So basically, we have to take a stand to say that violating someone's private parts when they are unable to give consent is not acceptable. And that's, that's what they are saying. And they're presenting a different, as I said before, a different, they're feminists, but they're responding to the issue in a way that I think has profound implications for our culture.
So let's talk a little bit about the Steubenville case. I found over and over in my coverage and reporting of the trial that people were confused about how anyone could deny that the rape happened or blame the victim, because there were just photographs of the entire situation that everyone saw. And yet not only was the victim being blamed, but the feeling was that in the community of Steubenville itself, the sympathy ran more towards the rapist and not towards the victim. Why does that happen? And why, the closer you get to the community that the rape happened, do you see more rape apologism and denialism?
Well, I think it's for all the reasons that we talked about. The I think the fear there's since rape is most rapists are not the stranger running out behind the bush in a ski mask, that anyone in our community could be charged with rape. Of course, the solution to that is not to rape, but I think instead we have this default position almost. I mean, I don't want to say it's a genetic position, but it seems to be a cultural position where we, in these cases, we want to blame the victim for being there and for drinking or doing whatever it was that put her into this victim position. And I think that's one part of it. I think the second piece is that our rape laws have very draconian penalties. And I think this scares a lot of people. Many people feel that although what the boys did was wrong, and morally wrong, that they should not go to prison for 30 years or whatever the penalty might be. In other words, and because of their youth, so some people believe that we should have more differentiated or graduated penalties. And when you have a situation where the youth are taking advantage of a comatose person who's intoxicated, perhaps that would be a lesser penalty than for a forcible rape and involving an adult where there was no alcohol involved. I don't happen to believe, that's not my position, but that what you might have is what I'm calling like jury nullification, that because the outcome is not what people want, then they want to find the person's not guilty. But it's really a very important question, because people outside of Steubenville, most of them, and I think, and you would agree with me, are basically in shock about what happened and the reaction of the people in Steubenville. So I think this case has really shown that we have a problem that we need to deal with. Why do we continue to have these cases? It seems like we never learn lessons from them. So I don't have a good answer as to what's going on in Steubenville, except to say that I think people tend, and maybe I'm wandering around here with your question. Maybe it's like the Holocaust. When the Holocaust and all the facts of the Holocaust comes out, people just want to deny it. They cannot accept that something this bad and so heinous could have occurred in their country, in Europe or whatever. And maybe that's the same thing that's going on. The whole world doesn't seem safe to us anymore if we have this kind of horrible thing going on. So we have to deny it.
My guest today has been Jodi Raphael, and her book is titled Rape is Rape, How Denial, Distortion, and Victim Blaming are Fueling a Hidden Acquaintance Rape Crisis. You can buy it online or at your local bookstore. Thanks so much for coming on to RealityCast, Jodi. I know this is a difficult topic. What is the matter with Kansas? Despite the fact that heavy anti-abortion activity in that state led to a man's murder in 2009, state legislators are determined to stoke the situation even more by passing even more restrictive laws on abortion. More restrictive, but also more ambiguous, to better create a situation where zealots can find avenues to harass abortion providers.
The sweeping new legislation, which is expected to take effect on July 1st, declares life begins at fertilization, blocks tax breaks for abortion clinics, and prevents them from providing information to public school students. It also forbids abortions based on gender.
The Kansas law stakes out a position for the state. It says that life begins at fertilization. It doesn't change when women in Kansas can get an abortion, but it changes the environment in which they might exercise their right to abortion.
Kansas isn't the first state to have some weird language about life beginning at fertilization, but in their environment, it's especially concerning. Before an anti-choice zealot assassinated Dr. George Tiller of Wichita, a district attorney named Phil Klein went on a legal digging operation on Dr. Tiller, trying to find some law he supposedly broke at the behest of the anti-choice movement in the area. After months of digging and putting the doctor on trial, nothing came of it because Dr. Tiller didn't do anything. In fact, Phil Klein was eventually brought up for disbarment because of his wildly unethical behavior and abuse of power in that situation. However, the targeting of Dr. Tiller for this kind of legal harassment was probably a contributing factor to his eventual murder, as his killer, Scott Roeder, was deeply upset that the BS harassment campaign did not result in shutting down Dr. Tiller's clinic. Kansas legislators took one look at this terrible situation and decided that the best bet was to create this Life Begins at Fertilization law, which seems to only serve the purpose of justifying more harassment of already beleaguered providers. Well, that, and apparently funnel money towards people who use it to proselytize instead of offer actual services.
Supporters say the declaration will not stop abortion providers from offering the same services, but it will likely give the state more discretion on which organizations the state funds. Supporters know a conservative administration could favor more conservative groups.
What may help is if they're going to be funding adoption agencies or giving more money to Department of Children and Family Services, that can help us or our clients because they may have more resources in which they can cling on to.
The woman they interview works at a crisis pregnancy center, which is to say that she spends her days trying to lure women with unwanted pregnancies into her center so she can try to bully them out of abortions. These centers often make promises they can't keep regarding the support of women who have their babies. That's why your eyebrows should be sky high at the claim that resources redirected from actual family planning clinics to crisis pregnancy centers could be used to help people. In other states, they've done that, and the result is very little help is actually offered. Women need real services, such as medical care and contraception, not being given a lecture on abstinence and a teddy bear to give their baby once it's born. Redirecting more money to places that don't use it for real services is a terrible idea. Unfortunately, that might be the least of the concerns here, because right now the anti-choice militants in the state are getting uglier and more overt with the insinuated threats of violence. David Leach of the Army of God posted audio of him talking with Dr. Tiller's murderer, Scott Roeder, online just in case abortion providers in Kansas didn't get the message.
My statement, if someone would shoot the new abortionist like Scott shot George Tiller, back in the Operation Rescue days, people, pro-lifers called him Tiller the Killer, hardly anyone will appreciate it but the babies.
These are the people who feel like the legislation has their back when they pass laws saying life begins at fertilization. This is very concerning indeed. But despite the fact that it's basically a big wet kiss to anti-choice militants who are making threats of terrorism, Governor Brownback of Kansas signed the bill into law. And he gave the raspberry to our First Amendment protections of freedom of religion while doing so, writing Jesus plus Mary at the top of his notes so the AP photographer could see it.
When I get down, you know I get down. When I get around, you know I get around.
And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, as much Pam Stenzel as you can take edition. NARAL sent out an email protesting the West Virginia situation I reported on in this podcast and reminded me that Pam Stenzel likes to threaten people with death and infertility if they use female-controlled contraception.
I will have a girl write me, email me, or come right up to me and say this. Well, my mom found out I was having sex, and so she put me on the pill. Or Depo, the shot, which is 10 times worse. What's that protecting that little girl from? What does birth control protect you from? In pregnancy most of the time. That drug, that hormone, that pill, that shot that this girl is taking has just made her 10 times more likely to contract a disease than if she were not taking that drug. This girl could end up sterile or dead.
This is a complete lie. There is no reason whatsoever to think that someone using the pill is more likely to get an STI than someone having sex without using any protection whatsoever. Stenzel's long history of anti-choice activism suggests something else entirely. She thinks non-procreative sex is wrong and will use any tactic, including lies and threats, to make sure as many women who are having sex are getting pregnant as possible, no matter if they're ready to be mothers or not.
That's it for this week's edition of RealityCast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.